Community Radio from South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Barbara Fuqua.
And I'm Scott Weddle. This is the Daily Local News for Wednesday, May 16, 2018.
If the EPA has designated this a Superfund site, it must be a particular hazard to the public.
The Environmental Protection Agency designated downtown Spencer as a Superfund site yesterday due to chemical pollution in the town's groundwater. In today's feature report, we will hear from IU Law Professor Robert Fishman about what impacts the designation as a Superfund site will have for area residents. That interview coming up later in the program.
This winter's Equifax data breach was worse than consumers were originally warned. Over 146 million Americans' social security numbers were exposed when the company was hacked. Better Beware's Richard Fish takes us through the numbers. On a new edition of our Consumer Watchdog segment, Better Beware is coming up later in the next half hour. But first, your daily headlines.
Indiana's Department of Natural Resources has withdrawn two controversial rule changes. The DNR director removed the two proposed rule changes today before they could go before a 12-person commission for a vote. One of the rules would have created a bobcat hunting season. The other would have required state-approved animal control workers to euthanize all raccoons, coyotes, and possums they capture. The rules were removed after meeting with significant public backlash. The meeting to approve the rules yesterday in Indianapolis saw around 100 Hoosiers in attendance. That's according to the Indianapolis Star. The rule changes also received thousands of comments on DNR's website. Members of the crowd cheered when DNR Director Cameron Clark announced the organization was dropping the move to create a bobcat hunting season and the required euthanasia of raccoons, coyotes, and possums. Other proposed rules by the DNR passed the committee. Those included moving several bat and bird species onto the endangered species list. One of the rules also removed several mussels, clam, and oyster species from the endangered list, as it is assumed the species died out several decades ago.
The General Assembly approved an oversight committee yesterday to investigate issues plaguing Indiana's Department of Child Services. WFHB correspondent Jonah Chester brings us this report.
Indiana legislators are taking steps to review the state's Department of Child Services. The Indiana Legislative Council approved an oversight committee to review DCS yesterday. Reform of the beleaguered department was a major policy agenda item for state Democrats during this year's legislative short session. Between late last year and this year, DCS has faced budget shortfalls, accusations of gross mismanagement, and increasing caseloads resulting from Indiana's ongoing opioid epidemic. In her public resignation letter in December, former DCS Director Mary Beth Bonaventura alleged that the department's current policies put children at risk. Bonaventura criticized Governor Eric Holcomb and the Indiana General Assembly in her resignation letter. She also alleged that her authority and power to manage one of the state's largest agencies was stripped by the governor's office after Holcomb appointed Eric Miller as DCS's chief of staff. In the letter, Bonaventura said that, quote, Miller has engineered the hiring of his choices, driven out career professionals, engaged in bullying subordinates, created a hostile work environment, exposed the agency to lawsuits, overridden my decisions, been brazenly insubordinate, and made cost-cutting decisions without my knowledge, unquote. State Senator Mark Stoops of Bloomington endorses the decision to create a DCS oversight committee. Stoops expressed many of the same complaints that Bonaventura did in her resignation letter.
We knew that some of the problems came from cost-cutting measures by Governor Holcomb. He installed his own staff person in the Department of Child Services who was tasked with cutting costs. And the way they did that was by cutting down on payments to service providers, cutting down on payments for placements in treatment facilities, and kind of getting in the way of standards that are in place to protect children. I think Governor Holcomb's staff person, Eric Miller, was inclined to try to keep kids in homes that were not safe situations. They thought they could save money by keeping kids in homes that you know, abuse was going on or addiction was causing a lack of care.
Stoops explained that the budget cutting has created difficulties in training and hiring new personnel. That's problematic for a state that's seeing an increasing neglected child caseload due to the opioid epidemic.
Right now, they're not paid enough. There's very little training. There's very little incentive for advancement within the Department of Child Services. And that's caused a problem, an on-the-ground problem, of the interface between families in need and the state of Indiana. On top of that, there's a problem with the new influx of kids that are from families that are dealing with opioid and heroin addiction. So that's caused a real increase in the number of families in need of treatment, and there hasn't been any real acknowledgement of that by the governor or the legislature in the form of a new direction.
Stoops adds that while the oversight committee is a good first step, he's not confident in their ability to represent the whole truth.
The committee's a good step. I think there's more that we could have done as a legislature during the session, but there's never a downside to having a deeper dive by a commission that can analyze exactly what has happened historically. And unfortunately, I think because of some of the appointments, we won't see details about the governor's and the legislators' actions and inactions that have caused some of this problem.
The Oversight Committee will release its final report on July 1st. The findings will be used to make recommendations for legislative solutions to DCS's issues. For WFHB, I'm Jonah Chester.
Bloomington Public Works Director Adam Wason reports a rapidly changing global recycling market could eventually lead Bloomington to charge residents for recycling. Wason provided the update to the Board of Public Works last night.
And when I say changing rapidly, the commodities for, you know, reuse or end use that have been recycled and processed at Hoosier disposal facilities, those markets are really tightening up. The markets in China are really, there's a big impact that they're having right now. Basically, any recycled cardboard or fiber products that would normally head to Chinese markets, China's no longer accepting those. You know, the market for glass has been down for years. Market for plastics is not doing well. Aluminum, metals always seem to do okay, but we're likely to face some pretty significant cost increases for recycling processing. Currently, we don't pay for recycling processing, but it sounds like we'll be having that come our way sooner than later.
The City of Bloomington contracts with Hoosier Disposal for trash and recycling. The recyclables are processed at a facility in Indianapolis.
Even with, you know, the change in the markets and such, you know, that I don't expect that there will be anything eliminated from the recycling stream. It just costs more to process it and find an end user.
Wason says the city is talking with Hoosier Disposal about the impact that an unstable recycling market could have on the city's trash and recycling rates.
I don't want to mislead the public one bit. We've often said that recycling is free in Bloomington to the customer, to the resident. By no means is it free. The trucks that we use, the fuel that we use, the manpower we use, there's certainly a cost to it. We've always been able to offset that cost with the subsidy or the support from the general fund and by not having to pay for recycling processing. A shift to having to pay for recycled processing will certainly have an impact on our financials and our analysis.
Wason says his department will notify the public ahead of any recycling service changes.
Wason also reported that construction at three major Bloomington intersections is on schedule.
Taproad Bridge should open by June 1st. Their hope is that they get it done before Memorial Day weekend, but June 1st is still their official date. So that will be a full opening of Taproad Overpass, which should help tremendously relieve some of the stress and volume of traffic there on 2nd Street. 2nd Street is on schedule to open towards the end of June in advance of the county fair, which will then hopefully provide some relief to 3rd Street. 3rd Street overpass is not scheduled to open fully open until substantial completion, which is scheduled for late August.
Wason told the board that traffic on the 3rd Street Bridge has now shifted. Two lanes are now open for eastbound traffic, where previously there was only one lane. Westbound traffic will now flow through a single lane until the project's completion in August. Wason referred to the 3rd Street intersection as a particularly difficult choke point. He says city traffic engineers will meet with the Indiana Department of Transportation representatives on Monday afternoon to monitor the new traffic configuration.
It's likely we will be working with NDOT to provide some staffing at the signals for that westbound traffic that's going to still be in the one-lane configuration with BPD. We're going to monitor, see how things are looking, but it's likely that we'll be authorizing some overtime and some additional hours for BPD to help with that traffic.
Wason says drivers may see flashing stoplights periodically due to electrical work being done on the signals.
Bloomington High School students are asking the city's government to step up efforts to combat climate change. The Bloomington Yes Society, that's YES Youth for Environmental Sustainability, presented a draft climate action resolution to the city's Sustainability Commission last week. A Yes Society member named Vera said actions by the U.S. government prompted the students to create the resolution.
Well, as we've seen with our government, there have been a lot of changes regarding to environmental policies, such as the U.S. has been pulled out of things like the Paris Climate Agreement, and we've been cutting funding towards the EPA, and we've repealed a bunch of environmental policies. And because of this, students from North, South, and the Academy have collaborated and created a few resolutions for Bloomington, Indiana to fight climate change.
Even though the U.S. isn't formally committed to the Paris Climate Accord, students believe that the city of Bloomington should work to fulfill the climate change agreement's goals. A Yes Society member named Maddie proposed requiring all new buildings to have green or white roofs or solar paneled roofs.
Green roofs would allow for carbon dioxide consumption and conversion to oxygen, which would be helpful in eliminating greenhouse gas emissions in Bloomington. White roofs would increase the amount of sunlight reflected away from the earth. This makes it cooler, just like wearing a dark shirt on a sunny day would make you warmer than a white shirt. And solar paneled roofs would allow for energy production, making them more useful and the buildings more profitable.
Students also proposed the city cut its natural gas usage by 10% and replace it with wind and solar energy. Other suggestions include installing refillable water bottle stations around town and planting one tree for every two that are cut down. Students were also keen to see the city increase bicycle accessibility.
Specifically, making it easier to access public high schools through bikes and thus like decreasing carbon emissions. We'd also like for the city to push towards a platinum bike city certification. We're a gold right now, but a platinum would send a message that our community is very dedicated to this and create a more sustainable climate.
Autumn Salamak, city's new assistant director of sustainability, says the city shares the students' goal of achieving platinum bike status. Salamak also said the city is working internally to set specific targets for natural gas and electricity reduction. Overall, the commission was impressed with the breadth of ideas the students presented in their first draft, though commission member Dave Rollo said some ideas will be easier to implement than others.
Support for WFHB comes from Cardinal Spirits Distillery, located on the B-Line. Cardinal Spirits has opened a new kitchen featuring local seasonal food made from scratch to complement their craft cocktails. Dinner is available Tuesday through Saturday at Cardinal Spirits, 922 South Morton Street. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Barbara Fuqua.
And I'm Scott Weddle. A groundwater plume contaminated with the solvent tetrachlorethine, or PCE, has led the EPA to designate the city of Spencer's municipal well field, which provides water to approximately 9,900 residents, as a Superfund site. The water is blended and treated before distribution to residents. Now, according to the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, the municipal water supply in Spencer meets the Safe Drinking Water Act standards. The source of the contamination is unknown, but IDEM has identified 9 active and former facilities that may be contributing to the contamination. PCE is a common toxic contaminant most often left behind by dry cleaners. It is considered a mild carcinogen, and prolonged exposure has been linked to an increased risk of Parkinson's disease and color blindness. WFHB News Director Wes Martin speaks with Maurer Law School professor Robert Fishman about what the designation of the town of Spencer as a Superfund site means for residents in South Central Indiana.
Professor Fishman, can you tell me a little bit about what a Superfund site is?
A Superfund site is a site that is designated by the federal government as being one of the very most contaminated sites by hazardous wastes. Very often, these are places that hosted industrial productions, industrial plants of various kinds. In the days before the mid-1970s, when states and the federal government began to regulate the manner in which people and companies dispose of hazardous waste.
According to the information that we have that has been released by the EPA, they hadn't identified a specific source, but the chemical contaminant that they're looking at is PCE, or tetrachlorethine, which to the best of my knowledge is a dry cleaning.
Yeah, so that's very common, but those sites aren't generally designated federal Superfund sites, so this must be an extreme case. So the contamination from dry cleaning operations is very common, and typically those are handled through state programs. If the EPA has designated this a Superfund site, it must be a particular hazard to the public. And the EPA uses a very complicated formula to rank sites and ultimately designate sites based on potential health risk. So that has to do with the concentration of chemicals. It has to do with the threat that groundwater will spread those chemicals. It also has to do with the likelihood that people will come in contact with those chemicals. So one thing to consider is if EPA has listed this site on the federal list, then it has already gone through the hazard ranking system, and taking a look at that report will tell you more about what is so dangerous about the site. I would say if I lived in Spencer and I learned about a Superfund site nearby, I too would be worried. But the good thing about being designated as a Superfund site is that, so the bad thing is it shows that there's a contaminated property. But there are lots of contaminated properties that aren't listed as Superfund sites that are just as dangerous. The advantage of being designated a Superfund site is it means the site is eligible for federal cleanup. So the federal government will sometimes fund cleanup of the site and then afterwards take responsibility for trying to reimburse as much of its cost as possible from potentially responsible parties.
So the EPA, when they're talking about opening this Superfund site, they were saying that Franklin and Main, which is right in the center of Spencer, they're calling that groundwater contamination site, quote, groundwater chemical plume. And I was just wondering, in terms of Superfund sites, what does cleanup or remediation of a site typically look like, in particular when we're talking about something like groundwater, which I can imagine would be much more difficult to deal with than what they're dealing with, for example, in Gary, which is kind of lead contamination in the soil.
Yeah, it's easier to dig up the soil and truck it to a hazardous waste landfill. And groundwater often needs to be pumped. It can be pumped and treated, but at the very least, by pumping the groundwater on the site, you are creating pressure that keeps the ground, that keeps the plume from spreading.
And of course, we've got some strange geology down in southern Indiana. There's this karst topography to southern Indiana where you have all of these kind of limestone bedrocks with fissures and cracks in different areas of it, and limestone itself being relatively porous. What would you say would be, I know that this is more of a hydrology geology question, but what would be the likelihood, for example, that we could see this groundwater contamination in Bloomington or in other communities in South Central Indiana?
Oh, I mean, that's not related to Superfund, but groundwater contamination is very common all around the country, including in Indiana. And, you know, the question is not whether there's contamination, but how serious the contamination is. I mean, any place that's been a dry cleaner for decades likely has the groundwater contamination. Same thing for gas stations, same things for, you know, old industrial sites. Part of the motivation for addressing some of those problems on industrial sites is so the industrial sites would be well suited for hosting new industry rather than directing new industry to what's often called green fields, where you're taking land that was never used for industry and dedicating it to that purpose without having addressed the older industrial sites.
Professor Fishman, is there anything else that you think our listeners should know with regards to Superfund sites or with regards to what this designation would mean for them or their property values?
So just that one, I mentioned that the bad news is that there must be a serious contamination problem or the site would not have ranked highly enough for EPA to list it on the Superfund list. The good news I mentioned is it does mean that federal funding is available. But I guess the other piece of good news is that many sites around the state and around the country are contaminated. We don't know a lot about that contamination. And if a site is designated as a Superfund site, there has been a lot of study done already and more to come. There'll be a remedial investigation, feasibility site, and all that information is available to the public. So people in Spencer, people anywhere, should be able to access very detailed reports about the site from the EPA's Superfund webpage information.
Professor Fishman, so they've designated Franklin Street and Main Street in the heart of downtown Spencer as a Superfund site. That's in the middle of this town. How far would that extend? What would be the perimeter of this Superfund site?
Superfund site areas are very enormously depending on the extent of the contamination. So you just have to look at the EPA record of decision that designates the site as a Superfund site, and it will say how large the site is. Sites are designated with particular boundaries.
Okay, Professor Fishman, thank you so much for speaking with us. I appreciate you taking the time.
You're welcome.
That was WFHB News Director Wes Martin speaking with Maurer Law School Professor Robert Fishman about the EPA's decision to add the town of Spencer to its federal Superfund site list.
The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Up next, our weekly consumer watchdog segment, Better Beware.
Well, Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
Several things this week, and let's start with some good news. Adrian Abramovich owned a Florida company that made robocalls, more than 96 million of them. And he got hauled up before a U.S. Senate committee where he weaseled around and took the fifth several times. Now, the Federal Communications Commission has hit him with a $120 million fine. Good for them, and good luck collecting it, but at least it sends a big fat message. On the other side of the coin, you remember the massive Equifax data breach last year? Equifax is one of the three main credit monitoring companies, and they admitted over 143 million Americans had their data stolen. Well, they've just issued a new report, and it's even worse. The total number is more like 146 million. They all had their full names and date of birth exposed, and almost all had their Social Security numbers stolen. The bad guys also got the full address for 99 million of us, phone numbers for over 20 million, and driver's license numbers for almost 18 million. Equifax now admits that the crooks got almost 2 million email addresses, over 200,000 credit card numbers with expiration dates, and more than 97,000 tax ID numbers. Congratulations! Used to be a lovely word, but now it can be a scary word. Are you getting pop-ups on your smartphone offering money, a gift card, or a free phone? The word congratulations is a big red flag, especially if you do Facebook on your phone. If you get a congratulations message, ignore it and swipe it away. If it keeps coming back, you might have to clear out your phone's memory. Whatever you do, don't respond. Don't click on anything, or you might end up giving the fraudsters access to your Facebook page and maybe your contacts list. At the very least, you're setting yourself up for an avalanche of spam and scam messages. Congratulations, my astrology chart. Finally, there's a hacking tool out there called Rowhammer that security researchers are working on. It hasn't been much used yet, but it's truly frightening because it works on the hardware, the chips in your computer, and cannot be blocked by a software patch. It keeps accessing or hammering the memory files until it actually causes some bits to flip from ones to zeros or vice versa and gives access to take control of the computer. Researchers at the VUSEC research group in Amsterdam have just demonstrated that Android phones are vulnerable to Rowhammer attacks. Every time someone comes up with a defense, they say, someone finds a way to get around it. About the only defense we have right now is to make sure your computer and your phone have the latest updated version of their operating systems. So check for updates today and stay tuned for more. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
Better Beware comes to you from WFHB Bloomington, Indiana. Find all our episodes at WFHB.org. If you can help put the kibosh on a con, email beware@WFHB.org. Remember, swindlers never give a sucker an even break.
Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Jonah Chester, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week. In partnership with Community Access Television Services, Better Beware was produced by Richard Fish. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
Our engineer today is Jenna Jankowski. Our theme music provided by Ben Lumstein, Danny Graff, and Scott Schmadeke. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, this is Scott Weddle.
And I'm Barbara Fuqua. Stay tuned for the Hijabi Diaries, a new program on WFHB exploring issues related to Muslim women in America. Coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a Daily Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at wfhb.org and catch live broadcast of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.